I think that most persons are interested a little bit in trying to find out the roots of their own individuality. But the great many, of course, do not really care. They take life as they know it for granted. They do not really ask the meaning of it, or the cause of it, or the consequences of the careers they live. To the great majority, life is accepted as a period of vitality and is concentrated in this structure that we call the human body. So this morning we want to see if we can learn a little about the person or relation between the outer world in which we live and the cause within ourselves. We want to know something about the person abiding in the body. Now, we know that man is a very complicated creature. We know also that the dweller in the flesh lives in a very impermanent and almost ineffective physical structure. Very few persons have the energy, the faculties, or the integrations necessary to fulfill their own ambitions or aspirations. They work hard over a period of years and find the body gradually failing them. All of these circumstances do not seem to result in any great study of the matter. It is all sort of taken for granted as part of the passing situations through which we all must pass. Let us then say to ourselves, in this material world in which we live, what part does the human being play in his own existence? I think we must admit that he plays a very important part. All of history, all of society, all of the experiences and discoveries of knowledge are all due to something inside of the human being. Civilization is nothing but a long shadow of something inside of the person. We have something inside of ourselves that built the pyramids, wrote the sacred books, waged all the wars, created all the art, and in addition to these major achievements, perpetuated the species itself with an infinite diversity of individualities. We also find that this being in the body doesn't function the same in all bodies. There is a great individuality here. As a result of that, the living thing in each of us tangles with the living things in others and result in turn in stress, strife, discord, and hatred. How do we understand then the way in which to approach the problem of what is inside of ourselves? Actually, we cannot turn our powers of comprehension inward. We have tried it, and some claim a measure of success. But for the most part, when we turn our conscious attention to the source of our own consciousness, we are stymied. We find that instead of finding answers, we find speculations. Each individual seeking the internal part of himself ends in speculations. He is not able to actually penetrate into the machinery of his own inner life. Having no fortune in this respect, therefore, it is necessary to do what we can. And one of the things we can all do is estimate, as far as possible, our own inner lives. We can interpret the conduct of other people, but we seldom correctly interpret our own. We express our attitudes of acceptance or rejections, to the thoughts of other people. But our own thoughts, which more or less drift with, going along with patterns that are often unreasonable, conflicting, contradictory, and may in some cases dangerous. So, let's see what would happen if we try to find out a little more about ourselves. I think perhaps Plato, quoted by Philo Judaeus, made an interesting statement, namely, that which goes into the mouth of the individual is material sustenance. But the best that comes out of the mouth in the form of speech can change the course of history. Therefore, nutrition is a private business. Expression, vocally, is a public concern. Each person, whether he realizes it or not, has a subtle determination to influence other individuals. He wants his own thoughts to be accepted by those around him. Nations expect their policies to be accepted by the rest of the world. Each person, however, is contriving to communicate his own inward feelings about matters and cause these to dominate the lives of other persons. So we have this problem of trying to estimate, if we can, what this power is inside of ourselves. Is it something that is unique to humanity? Do other creatures have this power? Is it something that evolves? Is it something that is bestowed by a power outside of the body itself? Is it a chemistry set up by the integration of the body? Is it largely dependent upon heredity or environment for its moldings? Everyone has at some time or another attempted to answer some of these questions. But for the most part, the answers have been conjectures. The actual problem of finding the real answer remains elusive. So we must try in our own way to see if we can find out why we think the way we do, why we believe what we believe, and how from this source within ourselves has emerged a consummate ingenuity by which we have filled the world with an infinite variety of manifestations of one energy power. Actually, we start in by the problem of energy, because whatever is in there is active. It is like a cell or a battery. It has power in there. Now, this power itself maintains all the other functions, and in the body primarily keeps the activity of the heart going through the length of our lives. This energy, however, is not necessarily the source of our opinions. It is rather the source of the machinery which makes opinion possible. It is also rather obvious that we are not completely dominated by heredity. We are not all of us dependent upon our ancestry. Actually, if we look down through history, we will notice that most outstanding and illustrious persons have come from humble backgrounds. And in turn, their children are comparatively humble. The power of the individual is not conferred upon his descendants, nor did he limit himself, or was he limited, by the comparative inabilities of his ancestry. Each of these units, which we call selves, is tremendously individual. Now, there is, however, a certain problem to bear in mind. We have to try to understand the computerizing processes by means of which the individual gradually becomes an almost universally functioning creature. How is this accomplished? We look at education and we find that it is ineffective. And more, there is a complaint from within ourselves that the education we are receiving is frustrating the purposes of that which is locked inside of our own natures. Therefore, education is not giving expression to this individuality, but is directing it forcibly into courses which are perhaps inconsistent with its basic patterns and purposes. There is also something else that seems to come out as we go along. There are two levels, apparently, of people. One of these levels is composed of persons who accept and obey the pressures of the environment without question. Whatever is done by others, whatever makes life more simple or convenient for themselves, they follow. Then there is another group, a smaller group, which does not accept these limitations, but strikes out to find expression or to solve problems that challenge the inner life. Now, the only place where the solution to the problem can be is within the individual. But most persons do not become aware of problem-solving powers, except to a very limited degree. So we start looking around, trying to find out how this person, this being in the body, functions. And the first point we come, of course, into face-to-face contact is that this power, whatever it is functioning through a body. It is a body which is a kind of house. And in this house, the being in the body lives, or exists, or functions. It is not only an occupant, it is a creator. It not only maintains bodies, but it fashions and modifies them. And this being seemingly is forever attempting to move the body structure into harmony with the purposes of the inner life. In other words, what the being in the body wants is that the body will serve its purposes. And one of the main problems we have today is a serious complex in this area. In other words, we are now trying to give to the body or to the personality that authority or that consideration which duly belongs to the being in the body. In other words, instead of the body becoming the useful servant of the being, it is now very largely a tyrant or a jailer, determining according to its own pleasures how this being is going to function. Under such conditions, we have a lot of conflicts in life, manifesting largely in the fact that individuals, forced by circumstances to accept patterns or conditions which are not according to the inner life, become frustrated, neurotic, and psychotic. The individual who is unable to use the body for the purpose of the being in the body is always at a disadvantage. Now, the body itself is a reasonably useful structure, but environment, world conditions, and many modifying factors are now greatly disturbing the proper relationships between the functions of the body. We find suddenly that this garment, which was supposed to be a useful working vehicle, has become incapable of its original purpose. And beside other circumstances, it has fallen a slave to vanities. It has allowed the person in the body only the privilege to do what the body wants done. Now, the body expresses through its own level of function by what we call appetites. These appetites are pressures in which the body wishes to do as it pleases. One of the major byproducts of these pressures is crime. It is crime either against society or against the body itself. The body punished by the ignorance or perversion of pressure is very often sickened and rendered incapable of serving the being in the body. The ancient philosophers, working with the problem, decided that whatever the ultimate life principle is, that this may properly be regarded as deity. That behind the forms, personalities, and instruments and bodies of nature, there is one eternal life principle. That this eternal life principle is not only a being, but a being which is inherently occupied and dominated by law. In other words, life and law are identical. Each one is a name for the other. Because life, in its own function, follows its own law inevitably. And the moment personal conduct varies from this pattern, there is trouble. In other words, the law or life within us has its own reason for existence. And that reason for existence may not be the same as the personal appetites of the individual. So the philosophers of old like to think of the power in the body as a spirit or a soul, or an energizing power within which is the infinite glory of a divine reality. In other words, the power within the individual is limitless and universal because it is the presence of a limitless and universal deity. As deity can do as it pleases. Deity can change anything it wishes to change. But deity, building up bodies, presents us with the mysterious allegory that we find in the opening chapters of Genesis. The purpose for human existence is a gradual revelation of the being in the body through the body, until the being in the body is completely the governor of conduct, and also gives us the perspectives which provide the incentives for true and eternal growth. Now, if the philosophers and the old theologians were correct, we have, therefore, within ourselves a mysterious agent that is our share of infinite life. This infinite life, in infinite manifestation, is also infinitely moving within each human being and is capable of an infinity of manifestations. To understand this, of course, is to be faced with the recognition of the almost the infinite opportunity that is locked within the person. Locked within the life itself is a pressure continually striving into manifestation. And this pressure is constantly meeting resistance, so that gradually the body becomes an impairment. It becomes a restriction and a limiting factor. Now, there are all kinds of circumstances that lead to this condition. And here, perhaps, we have some reason for considering the possibility of heredity. Not that man inherits the inner life, but he does sometimes and may frequently inherit the weaknesses or imperfections of the physical body, which belong to his family, his race, or his world at that time. Therefore, the power within is constantly meeting a kind of objection, a pressure from below, a pressure that gradually results in the development of mind as a bridge between the divine and the mortal. Mind is a link. Mind is something that you can educate from below, but must enlighten from above. In other words, the mind can be taught by schooling, by instruction in very many fields. But this instruction is not valuable, actually, unless it contributes to the release of the life factor within the individual. Therefore, education nowadays has become more or less a burden upon the inner life, rather than a means of releasing it. Between the average individual and the releasing of this one divine energy, there stands a mass of modifying, conflicting attitudes, reactions, and instructions. The person is not allowed the simple process of searching for the reality in himself. Now, Western philosophy has largely turned towards industrialized materialism. The individual now assumes that the life within himself is primarily concerned in helping him to become rich, powerful, autocratic, and successful in what we would term materialism. If the mind does not contribute to wealth, the individual feels defeated or underprivileged. And if the life in him begins to complain against what he does to gain wealth, then he turns upon himself and regards himself as a victim of theological superstitions. In other words, anything that interferes with his intention becomes a kind of fallacy, which he tries to place elsewhere and get rid of in order that he can continue his processes of accumulation. Now, we see this very often and very commonly, but to get into the very depth of it, we have to go still further. Actually, in the Orient, there has been a lot of thought given to this problem of the interference of mind and the pressures of materialism with the natural growth of the internal life. The only thing about the human being that is important is a partnership between the life within him and the conduct of his own daily existence. Unless he makes this adjustment, he is going to always have a certain amount of conflict. This was the secret of the alchemical philosophy that flourished during the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries in Europe. It was a problem, actually, of transforming the lower into the use value of the higher. In other words, it was the problem of making the soul itself become flesh in and through the body. If the inner life functions normally and naturally in the body and devotes itself to the reason and expression of its own purposes, the individual will have very little difficulty with the problems of living. The old teacher said that the body, where it is free from opinion and free from the conflicts of lower emotional and mental attitudes, can endure almost indefinitely. And it has even been scientifically recommended that we should hope that in the course of time we will be able to live 150 or 200 years in reasonably good health. The thing that is destroying us is the pressure and conflict between life and ambition, between the energy which sustains us and the misuses of that energy, or the abuses of it, or the corruption of the body so that the energy can no longer function. We will always be in trouble as long as the body is an impairment, as long as it remains as a blocking of the energies of life. And when we can have the body serve life, things work very much better. Now, we also, however, inherit into the body when we are born a whole outside environmental picture of things. We are born into a nation, a race, into a community, into a family. And these pressures move in on us immediately because none of these institutions are really centered in the divine purpose for things. They are all centered in trying to assure survival in this world. But because the survival here is inconsistent with the purposes of the essential life in man, nothing really succeeds. Everything becomes an endless struggle, trying to prevent mistakes from catching up to us. And if they do catch up, that we will find some way of temporarily neutralizing their effects. We therefore grow into a world which is not the one we belong to. We can't go into all the details, but we can point out, for instance, that in the Orient, this has been discovered, has been realized, and it is a known fact, to these people at least, that through quietude and detachment from the causes of death, that the individual is capable of making a creative adjustment with the eternal life within himself. The thing that he has to get rid of is the false appetites and the false decisions made by the mind to serve the ambitions of the body. Now, the body actually, however, is not as bad as we sometimes think it is. It's not really a nasty thing at all. It isn't a wicked thing. It isn't an evil structure. It is something that is simply the instrument of whatever runs it. And if the mind and the emotions become the leaders of the body, they can lead it into destruction. They can destroy its purposes and functions, and in so doing, ultimately, force its separation from the life principle with which it is intimately associated. With one life in the body, moving from its own secret sources, we must realize that there is only one life in society, also moving towards its natural results and purposes. And instead of living as we do now, with everyone having their own private world and nations at each other's throats all the time, if we could realize that all nations, all individuals, all planets, and even all cosmic systems are sustained by one energy, this one energy is the common denominator of all that exists. If, therefore, we could once come to serve that energy as it wants to be served, we would end merely all of the conflicts and confusion of mortal existence. But while each individual places himself as a judge of what the inner part of himself decides or demands, he is in trouble. So we still have to start a little bit now and just begin to study ourselves. Now, this is a very interesting study, and it is not at all necessarily egocentric. It is not that we are studying it in order to gain some kind of glory. What we are trying to do primarily is to study the compound so that we can become capable of living according to the life principle within us. If we are able to do that, most of the secondary difficulties will fade away. So we have to start by finding out a little bit about the habits of our own thinking. In other words, become observant, thoughtful, or aware of our own functions. Now, the bodily problem is not so serious with most people if they can handle the mental and emotional problems. So when you make a decision, try to understand why you've made it. Face the facts of decisions. Why do you want to do a particular thing? What part of your compound does this action serve? And from what level of your consciousness did the impulse to perform this action basically emerge? You can say to yourself usually that the action is one of self-interest of some kind. It's doing what you want to do, or trying to avoid what you do not want to do. Now, those two problems of avoidance or fulfillment open a way to understanding ourselves in a much more brilliant manner than any educational system can bestow. In other words, each action, each thought, should be weighed in terms of its relationship to a universal good or a personal self-centeredness. The universal is impersonal. The universal is something in which all parts exist to serve the totality. Individuality is very largely personal, and the more we have of it, the more dangerous it comes to be. So when we find that we avoid a responsibility, or we try to take on a debt that we cannot afford, Or we say something sharp and unpleasant to a friend or neighbor. Or we find no time to take care of children because of our own interests. We should take each of the decisions that we make and follow it along the line of Kant's categorical imperative, which is an excellent way of estimating ourselves. When we make a decision, or when we choose to do a certain thing in the face of choices, we can say to ourselves, if everyone in the world made a decision like mine at this moment, would it be fair, honorable, and constructive to everything that lives? Would I want, in other words, to live in a world ruled over by the decision I'm making on this particular occasion? Would it be fair? Would it be happy for others as well as myself? If I have decided that I don't have time to fulfill a moral responsibility, would my world be happy if nobody had time to do it? Or is it something that others should have time for, but I have other interests? This categorical imperative is very, very useful in self-determinations because it indicates the danger of the generalization of a particular. Now, if we overspend ourselves, are we doing that which is according to the best good of our own inner lives and the best good of our society? Or in the effort to overspend ourselves, do we demand more raises of pay and things of this type until inflation moves in and destroys it all? We either have to live according to principles or die for lack of them. And this point is becoming more and more obvious in our daily thinking. So if we say, I want something, can we justify this want in terms of a great good to something besides the fulfillment of our own desires? Now, when it comes to such habits as narcotics and alcoholism, we have other examples to consider. There is no possible way in which the average individual can justify becoming an alcoholic. But it is something he feels that he wants to do at the moment, and it largely involved in shirking responsibility or trying to return to infancy. This type of ailment can destroy the body and will do so if we do not correct it. But when we destroy the body in this case, we perform a sin against the spirit which is in that body and which is there to help that body and that person to fulfill its place in life. Alcoholism is a dead end for millions of units of energy. It is an end in which the divine purpose of life itself simply fades out because of the destruction of the physical instrument in which it must function. The only answer then is reincarnation, another body, and also an uncorrected weakness which could well be transferred into the future. So we have to try to prevent this energy, which is the divine power in us, from being so blocked that it results in a world in which there is nothing but sin, crime, and corruption. Everything has to be based upon the use of this energy. Now, if this energy was simply an electrical power that you could put a quarter in the meter and do what you want to with it, it would be different. But this energy is not that kind of an energy. It is what the Greeks call a moral energy. Every use of this energy is a responsibility. This divine power is not for free. You cannot buy it. You must become a useful instrument for it. But it is not something that is yours simply because you're born, and you can do with it as you please. If you take this attitude, you will find very little happiness or comfort in life. You will find yourself drifting further and further into complexities that become so burdensome that you begin to look forward to death as a hope of release. Now, because this energy has a lawful structure, because the soul power in man or the spirit or the being in man, whatever you want to refer to it, is a life with a code of conduct. Its use is built in. Its purposes are controlled by a law of absolute integrity. Every part of the function of the pure life itself is reasonable, is proper, and is inevitably right. But whenever this power comes into conflict with self-will, then we are reminded of the ancient statement in the Talmud about the self-will. And it is said that that was what destroyed the prehistoric world. And that because of self-will, so fell the angels. The revolt against heaven is the revolt against the proper use of the life principle within yourself. It is the actual revolt against truth, revolt against wisdom, against love, against service, against everything that makes things important. And if this rebellion is carried far enough, the individual simply uses, wrongly or not at all, the energy resources that he has. He therefore gradually passes out of this life without having learned its lessons, and not having found any of the joys that come from integrity and dedication. So in this particular instance, we have to take it for granted that there must be some way in which this life in us can tell its story. And probably the ancient mystics and the theologians of the remote past who gave us the great religions of the world brought from the inner life of themselves or from space itself something like the Decalogue of Moses that was given by the finger of God in the clouds of Sinai. There have been revelations by means of which the individual has been given the key to his own salvation. We find it in the Ten Commandments. We find it in the teachings of Jesus, in Buddha, Zoroaster, Hermes, Confucius, Lao Tzu, Pythagoras, all of these great people who were the real teachers of mankind, pointed out this inevitable truth that as we are able to control the false pressures of ourselves, we return again to friendship with the divine. We find our own unity with reality by consciously rising above unreality and illusion. Actually, therefore, this problem of getting at this inner core of things is probably through a meditational process. But the meditational process is not valuable unless it is supported by a definite, honorable, conscious dedication. A meditation that does not alter conduct is an illusion. The individual who loves God but does not love his fellow man is getting nowhere, regardless of all the platitudes he may think up or all the defenses he may construct for his own action. The law works in a certain way. The law says there are no enemies in my level of consciousness. Therefore, it is not tolerable in the embodied being. Everything that is part of the eternity in us is completely controlled and mathematically structured in an integrity that is incorruptible. So it is not what the law can do to please us, but what we must do in order to keep faith with the law. This is the important consideration. Actually, today, confusion and sorrows and miseries are making deep inroads into our personal attitudes. Probably for the first time in many persons' lifetime, thoughts concerning integrities are coming into focus. We are beginning to realize that something is wrong. And we are also beginning to realize that prayers without works are not going to remedy the situation. And also that all the materialistic compromises that we ever make, industrially, economically, or militarily, will never solve the problem. There can never be a war that will bring peace. There never can be a world materialistic civilization that can bring security or happiness to the people of the world. All things finally decide in shifting, or result from shifting, the level of leadership from the materialistic factors that we now more or less are slave to, and restoring our allegiance to that which is without fault or blemish, that which is the integrity of things. In other words, man must find ways of restoring the golden age of integrity in his own world. And that means that he must follow the leadership of life and not the leadership of death. He must gradually and inevitably weed out his own mistakes. Now, we might say that should be a legislation to do this, that they should pass a law and make it obligatory. Unfortunately, this type of law will not be passed because those who most need it are most afraid of it. They are not concerned with making it work. They would be very unhappy if they found that it did work. Because if selfishness can be proven to be a complete failure, we might have a better kind of world to live in. It has proved that it is a failure, but a lot of people are clinging to the hope that they are going to be exceptions to the general condition, that they can do as they please and all will be well, but other people cannot. So here we have the problem that we must shift our allegiance. Now, theology attempted to do this, but unfortunately, theology also settled back onto the level of the mind and the personal claims of people.